Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we will be talking with Dr. Gail Thomas, Clinical Assistant Professor at UNC's Department of Family Medicine and Medical Director of the North Carolina Farm Worker Health Program, about farm workers and health.
This sounds a lot more than groceries.
It is. The people behind our food. We have a chance to really talk about the issues that they face and all the complexity of what goes behind the grocery store.
I'm looking forward to being educated and hearing about regulation and all kinds of things that I don't know a whole lot about, but I think are important.
I know. But first, we've got some research that matters. We're going to talk about some of these medicines called proton pump inhibitors or acid-reducing medicines and a link to B12 deficiency.
We're going to find out if Christy and I's eating habits are influenced by what we think other people eat.
And we're going to talk about getting antibiotics before heart surgery to protect against infection.
And then finally, we got a sexy topic. We're going to talk about
sex
and doctors. Do patients, particularly teenagers, talk about sex with their doctors?
Yep. Okay, let's talk about our first one. And this is about acid-reducing medication. So a lot of us take these medications for what we call acid reflux in our stomachs, where you get that burning sensation. So people take now over-the-counter proton pump inhibitors like omeprazole or things that block histamine like ranitidine or Zantac, a lot of these medicines, and they look to see if there's some link between that and B12 deficiency.
This was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and this question about do these drugs that block the acid, do they lead to more B12 deficiency because you need that acid sometimes to be able to absorb the B12 in your diet. And so there's some question here in the previous research. And in this particular case, they found that it did lead to a small increased risk of B12 deficiency if you were on these proton pump inhibitors for a prolonged time.
Yeah, so it was only in the patients who had taken them for more than 2 years, and it was in only a minority of those patients, but you were more likely to have some element of B12 deficiency or low levels of B12 if you're on these medicines for more than 2 years.
Particularly if you were actually younger when it was diagnosed. A lot of our patients, Christy, it's older people who tend to be on these for a longer period of time because they've had really bad reflux. Now, does that mean that you should get off of your proton pump inhibitors if you really need them, like you have really bad reflux? Probably not, but if you could have a short period off of them for various periods of time, or more importantly, you could just check a vitamin B level, B12 level.
I think if this is something that you're taking regularly, it's something to bring up with your doctor. You could just get a quick level and see if it affects you, and also to take it only during the times when you really need it.
Why are they called proton pump inhibitors, Christy? What's this? What's a proton?
Didn't you go to medical school? It blocks this little pump in your stomach, the proton pump, and it inhibits that so that decreases the amount of acid that your stomach
spits out. So these aren't the neutrons and the electrons and the protons.
Well, you're getting a little
complicated for the radio
here. I'm
getting into some physics here and physiology. Okay, we'll have to come up with this another time. But interesting question. And speaking of the next Research That Matters question, this is about food. And does it really matter what other people eat or knowing what other people eat in terms of what you eat? What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think most certainly that makes sense to be intuitively true. But they looked at some research in the United Kingdom. They did what we call a systematic review, where they take multiple different research studies and pool them all together to try to figure out, well, what's actually the truth.
And this research, published in the Journal of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, found that it really does matter that people eat less overall when they're given information that people are eating less overall. They eat more overall when they don't have this information. So knowing that people eat healthier, eat smaller portions in your environment, that normative, those norms, those established patterns, if you know that other people are doing it, you tend to follow that more than if you don't.
Well, it speaks to how complex it is, really, if you're in a family or an extended family where the culture is a lot of rich eating and a lot of focus on eating, then it's even harder, I think, to make healthy choices. But this implies that if you know that people are making better choices, then you might do it too, a little peer pressure.
Yeah, what they don't know fully is if you give people communication messages or public health mass media campaigns and you tell people everyone's eating healthier, everyone's eating low-calorie foods, does that mean that those messages will actually result in more people doing that if those messages weren't actually true? So I think there's something about the truth of mm-hmm. what you're saying. No matter what, it has to be true. That's, I think, it's important.
Well, and I mean, just for my own life, I'm eating healthier if I'm in a community of people. Everybody's been doing paleo, so we're all doing that now. But I feel like I'm paying a lot more attention to it because I'm in a community where people are talking about it. So surround yourself with healthy people.
You look healthy, Christy.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It must be because of the food you're eating.
It must be, and the exercise. Okay, let's talk about antibiotics before surgery.
So for all of our listeners out there who've ever had surgery, raise your left hand. Okay. Now, the question is, did your doctor...
Not while driving, I hope.
Not while driving, no. And for those of you who had heart surgery, did your doctors give you antibiotics before surgery? And when did they give them to you? Was it the night before? Was it right when they cut on your heart? You probably wouldn't remember that. Or was it 2 hours before the surgery, like this particular study recommends?
We know that giving antibiotics before surgeries can reduce infections for lots of different types of surgeries. And this was a study where they looked in Israel over a 10-year period following forward to see if optimizing the policy for giving those antibiotics 2 hours before surgery made a difference in the infections to those heart incisions.
And it really did. They cut down the number of infections after surgery from 14% to a little over 8% when those preoperative antibiotics were given in those 2 hours beforehand. And that's pretty impressive, I think. Also a little disheartening because it also still means that 8% of people are still getting infections, but they cut down 50 to 60% of the infections, and it suggests that should be a standard of care.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you're getting heart surgery, it's worth asking the question of what is the policy in your hospital. Let's talk lastly about doctors and teenagers talking about sex.
Yeah, this is a sexy study, but it's a problematic study. I think Christy and I will both agree. But this was actually research done at Duke School of Medicine, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Pediatric Journal, about how often do providers, family doctors, and pediatricians have conversations with their pediatric patients about sexuality during the clinical visit.
So we know that one-on-one confidential time with the doctor and the teenager during the sort of yearly well child check is recommended that we ask parents to leave the room so that we can have some of these real conversations and guide these children appropriately. But this was a study where they audio taped a bunch of different annual visits, including camp and sports physicals, for 253 teenagers. And then they went through and tracked how many of the doctor visits actually mentioned, asked questions about sexual activity, and how much time they spent talking about that.
So if you're a doctor, you had to sign off probably on this study saying, we know that you're going to talk with your patient, and if you talk about sex, it's going to be recorded here on the conversation.
Or maybe they didn't tell why, but...
And then the patients have to sign and agree that, well, we're going to be audio taping, we're going to be having a recorder of a conversation that may also include sex or other sensitive subjects. So a lot of problems here. And actually, I was surprised that two-thirds of the time the doctors did have conversations with their patients for up to a minute. Now, the researchers maybe sounded like this was not very much or very often, but I thought actually it was better than I would have thought, given the limitation.
Yeah. So physicians on average spent about 22 minutes in the exam room, and about 3% or less was devoted to topics related to sex. So, I mean, the study itself might have been fraught. If I knew I was getting audio taped as a teenager, I might not be as forthcoming. But I do think it raises this issue and reminds us as parents to encourage our children to talk with their doctors about everything, and as doctors to make sure that we're getting that one-on-one time and really talking openly about these things. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of the show. We're going to take a break, but when When we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Gail Thomas, clinical assistant professor at UNC's Department of Family Medicine and the director of the North Carolina Farm Worker Health Program, about farm workers and health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Gail Thomas, clinical assistant professor at the University of North Carolina's Department of Family Medicine and medical director of the North Carolina Farm Worker Health Program, about farm workers and health.
We're so glad you're with us, Dr. Thomas. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You know, let's there are a couple of things we want to do right up front. And one is to hear about you and how you became interested in this topic and to lead in this way, but also to help our listeners really understand when we're talking about farm worker health, what are we talking about? So start off either way, however you want to tell that story.
Well, I'm a family practice physician, as are you. And I have worked for about 23 years in the Carrboro Community Health Center, where many of my patients were Latinos. And I, over the years, developed a real love for and respect for the Latino culture. When I left Carrboro Community Health Center, I was excited to find a position that used some of those skills and background in a new way. So as medical director of the Farm Workers Health Program, I am a medical consultant to a program that I think is really innovative in the way it delivers health care to a really underserved part of the population. Our model is to train outreach workers, who are people who speak both English and Spanish, and go out to the fields where the farm workers are actually working and living, to interview them, talk to them, assess them, and then connect the ones that need medical care with affordable health care nearby. And this is a statewide program. So we have 11 different sites scattered across the state. And we work in places where there really aren't a lot of doctors and nurses, but we're able to go out into the fields with our outreach workers.
So if we were to take a state like North Carolina, how many farm workers are there in the state? And how, you know, and when we think about, like, kind of nationally, is this a big issue? I mean, think most of us, when we go into a grocery store, we're walking down those produce aisles. We don't think about, where did that orange, that apple, those grapes, the corn come from? But we should be thinking about this. And so help us, give us a context. How do we begin to think about farm workers and health?
Well, I completely agree with you. And I think that as we see the rise of people who want to eat locally and responsibly and sustainably, it's inevitable that we start thinking about the people who are harvesting and cultivating the food that we eat. It's hard to say exact numbers, but nationally it's estimated there are about 3 million farm workers. Here in North Carolina, we have, according to the latest estimates for 2013, about 84,000 farm workers. If you include their families, and our project does try to reach their families as well, that's 150,000 people. We are part of a network of migrant health centers, which are actually brick-and-mortar clinics that are given money by the federal government to reach out to migrant and seasonal farm workers. And we collaborate with them, but our project actually aims to serve the places that fall through the cracks where there aren't any migrant health centers.
So when we think about, we often toss around farm workers and migrant farm workers and seasonal farm workers. How do we think about that? Are people coming just to do their work and then going home to other countries, or how does that work?
Yes, actually, the majority of people are coming just to do work. They may not go all the way back to another country when their work is done. They may go to another state. But a migrant farm worker is somebody who moves for work or has technically moved for work in the last 24 months, whereas a seasonal farm worker is somebody who lives in one place and works in agriculture, and the majority of the income in that family is coming from agricultural work, whether it's something they do year-round or only during harvest time.
So I've heard that farm workers, typically that job is considered one of the most dangerous jobs. And it's, I guess that struck me because I wouldn't have thought that offhand. I would have thought, oh, it's not as dangerous. You're out there and you're picking vegetables. That's, you know, you can tell the city boy here in me. Why is it that it's a dangerous profession? And give us an example or two of maybe of the sorts of things that you and your colleagues might see.
Yeah, well, I think it's a dangerous profession in part because you're exposed to the elements. You know what the heat and humidity is like in North Carolina, and you can imagine working 12 hours in that heat and humidity. Heat exhaustion and heat-related illness is very, very common. There's a lot of chemicals involved in agriculture now, both fertilizers and pesticides. And farm workers and their families tend to live in the fields or next to the fields where they work. And there's a lot of spraying and drift that drifts onto them as they're working or as they're at home outside playing. When they touch the plants, obviously, they come in contact with these pesticides. Even the plants themselves can have toxicities. Green tobacco sickness is very common. I don't think I've ever talked to a farm worker who harvests tobacco that hasn't had green tobacco sickness.
Which, for our listeners who don't harvest tobacco, what sort of symptoms would they have?
Basically, you absorb the nicotine through your skin instead of absorbing it through your lungs by smoking it. So as they're out in the fields, especially if the tobacco leaves are wet or if they themselves are perspiring, which they usually are, the wetness combined with the leaf as they tuck it under their arm as they go down the row harvesting the leaves gives them a really high nicotine level, and that can cause severe headache, nausea, vomiting, a lot of insomnia. It's basically like somebody who's just smoked a lot of cigarettes.
And so I saw a report saying that farm workers make roughly $11,000 a year. I don't know if that might be old, but somewhere roughly in that area. And that seems like for a family, if that's really would be very challenging to live on. What kind of resources does our state have resources for them, or what kind of resources do they have just to survive?
Well, sadly, there aren't a lot of resources set aside for these people. I think they are very much under the radar, and because a lot of them are not here year-round, they don't qualify for a lot of resources. There are some money set aside for preschools for migrant kids, and our program is definitely one of the places that the federal government has put money, as well as the migrant health centers. But to qualify for Medicaid or for the Medicaid for Children, the CHIP program, you have to either be a citizen of the United States or a permanent resident for at least 5 years. So not many of the migrant or seasonal farm workers fall into that category, so they often can't access those resources.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Gail Thomas about farm workers in health and her vision for how North Carolina and perhaps around the country can help solve some of these pressing health problems. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Gail Thomas, clinical assistant professor at UNC's Department of Family Medicine, the medical director of the North Carolina Farm Worker Health Program, about just that, farm workers and health. And before the break, Dr. Thomas, you were sharing with us just some of the challenges that these families have making as little as $11,000 a year and not qualifying for a lot of resources. And understand your program does a lot to reach out to them. Give us an example or two of families that have been impacted by your outreach workers.
Well, one story that I was told recently was that our outreach worker went out to visit a family to find that their housing lacked heat, and this was in a cold time of the year, and that the baby had pneumonia and almost certainly would have died if the outreach worker had not made contact with this family and gotten the baby to care in time. I think it's really hard for these families and for the single men. The majority of farm workers are single men and they leave their families behind. But it's very hard for them linguistically. Most of them do not speak English, so it's hard for them to navigate our healthcare system. The majority of them do not have health insurance, so that presents a barrier. Many of them do not have transportation either. They are transported to and from work by the grower that they work for, and the rest of the time they're pretty much isolated in their grower-provided housing on the side of the field. So when they need help, it's hard for them even to get the transportation to get to the doctor. Our outreach workers are able to provide transportation. We also provide funds to help cover the cost of their care and their medicines and translation services, too, if the doctor or the mid-level we're taking them to doesn't speak Spanish.
Well, are there legal protections here, and are there moral obligations that business owners have towards the health care of their workers? And where do these things intersect, and what's the politics of farm workers and health?
That's a very complicated question. I would encourage your listeners to look online at a website called ncfan.org. And FAN stands for Farm Worker Advocacy Network. And they're a coalition of organizations, of which my organization is an advisory member, that work on some of those legal aspects. Sadly, a lot of the job protection laws that most of us enjoy, such as overtime, sick leave, workmen's compensation, by law, those don't apply to farm workers. Even the child labor laws are different for children who are working on farms.
What do you mean?
They can legally work on a farm if their parents are nearby as long as they're over 10 years of age. They can work without their parents over 14 years of age.
And those are children working in these farms across North Carolina?
Up to 30 hours a week. These laws come, you know, to us from the 1920s when a lot of people worked their family farms and the child labor was important to the family. But we're talking about children who are now working in big agribusinesses. And there have been recent efforts to try to change those laws. Unfortunately, they were unsuccessful. Even though kids are a very small percentage of the farm workers in the United States, they account for 20% of the deaths in farm workers. So it's a very dangerous place for a child to be.
Wow. And is that, I mean, are these families just in that situation where they, you know, when a child comes of age, they need to put them to work in order to feed the other siblings?
Yeah, as you noticed, the average income for a farm worker is $11,000 a year, and that doesn't go very far. So that's for one person. I think the average income for the family is more like $16,000 a year, but still not very much. Hmm.
So I know that increasingly all of us are becoming much more aware of the possibilities of foodborne illnesses and farm illnesses that translate into foodborne illnesses, spinach or lettuce that are contaminated at the farm level, state fairs with animals and this E. coli bacterium. Is this a trend that you think we are going to become more concerned about farm workers and health, food and health? Or do you think that this is only going to happen when someone gets sick?
That's a good question, Adam. Clearly, we all live in the same environment, and when people near us or people who are growing or packing our food are sick, there's a chance that that's going to be transmitted to us. A study in 2010 in North Carolina of farm workers' living situations tested their water, and a third of them were found to have unsafe water supplies. So they weren't even being given water that met the minimum requirement for safety. If those farm workers become ill, and if they're out working in a field without the legally required bathrooms, you can understand how that could make all of us sick.
Well, so what's it going to take? Is it going to take somebody in a position of power getting sick from that? Or, I mean, to me, this is a human rights topic as well as just a basic concern for health safety. But what's it going to take for people to pay more attention? I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think programs like yours that are bringing this to the forefront. I think watching a movie that you can again find at the ncfan.org website, it's called Harvest of Dignity. People can go on that website. They can download information to educate themselves and their friends and family. They can sign petitions. They can start to bring pressure to bear on our legislators. Many people will remember Cesar Chavez in California and all the activity that went on to bring issues like this to the forefront. And as a response, California has some of the better laws across the United States in terms of the rights and responsibilities of the growers and the farm workers. North Carolina has the sixth highest number of farm workers in the U.S. It's a big part of our state industry and budget. I think it accounts for 20% of our state's income. So this is an important issue for us as well.
Well, we really want to thank you, Dr. Gail Thomas, for coming and starting a conversation with your health listeners. We have listeners all across the country. Many of them are in farm belt states like North Carolina, like California, Idaho, Iowa. Really important issues that you raise, that this is a national issue, probably an international issue, we're quite certain. And we thank you for taking your time and professional path to make this a priority for all of us.
Well, on behalf of the farm workers, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Please stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you've got a question, concern, a story, something you'd like Christy and I to talk about on an upcoming show, you can send it to us at yourhealth.unc.edu, and we'll be happy to discuss it. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to tell us, what is our very first house call today?
I'm a middle-aged man who has been told I have prostatonia. What's the difference between this, an enlarged prostate, and prostatitis?
Well, three good conditions, right?
Yeah, well, three not-so-fun conditions, really.
No, but three important ones.
Yes, that's the truth. So, prostatidinia is when your prostate hurts or is inflamed, and there's pain coming from that. And right. That can be different than having an enlarged prostate, which is when you hear people talk about BPH or benign prostatic hyperplasia.
Or even prostatitis, which is infection most typically due to bacteria in an organism, but could be elsewise. Some people call prostatidinia chronic pelvic pain in men, which maybe a lot of our listeners thought, this only happens in women. But no, it can happen in men too. Great question. And we're happy you brought it up because it gives us a chance to talk about that sometimes those things happen and there are some potential causes and potential treatments.
So I think most of all is making sure that you kind of rule out infection or large prostate or some of those things as being part of what's going on, just to make sure you're targeting properly. But taking anti-inflammatories or thinking of this as like an inflammatory process by taking things like Advil or Motrin or those kinds of things can make a difference in your discomfort.
Some people will try certain things in their diet, things that we oftentimes recommend perhaps to people to cut down on irritation of the prostate, things like avoiding caffeine, avoiding alcohol, tea, soda drinks, diet drinks that have caffeine. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of data that that actually helps, but it probably doesn't hurt to try that either. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, having regular sex, of course, in a safe, you know, setting with one partner can be helpful just to kind of keep things moving and to decrease the pain in that area.
Sometimes doctors may use the term therapeutic ejaculation, which is another term for having sex with the partner or for masturbating. And that is interesting that, again, there's not a lot of data that that therapeutic ejaculation necessarily helps. And in each patient, it may be different. But it is interesting to know that at one point in time, 100 years ago, it was thought that ejaculation may be a cause of this, or masturbation may be a cause of the chronic pelvic pain in men.
Confusing.
Now it's in potential one of the treatments, or it used to be even 30 years ago, Christy, they did, guess what? Therapeutic massage of the prostate, frequently done by the urologist or the family doctor, 1 to 3 times a week for several weeks. Turns out most patients don't like that.
No, I would imagine not, especially if it hurts.
And it may not help either. So this is a difficult condition. We don't have great answers, but we're beginning to understand it, and at least we can talk and work with you. So thank you for that particular question. Mm-hmm. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I have chronic back pain from bad arthritis in my back. My doctors don't want to give me pain medication because I used to drink too much and I used cocaine. I don't do this any longer, but should I be able to get pain medication?
Oh, that's so complex. And I'm sorry that you're in pain and that you're feeling like you can't get what the thing that you feel like you need, which I think is it's just a hard spot to be in.
Yeah, this question may not be a black and white question. It may be a shade of gray mm-hmm. question here. And you may hear Christy and I hedging a little bit here. We certainly think that you should get treatment for your pain. The real question is, should you get opiates or chronic narcotic medications for your pain? Which is, I think that's kind of probably what you're asking here, because everyone can get some sort of pain relief from multiple other reasons. What do you think, Christy? Does this automatically disqualify you?
Well, I think you both you and your doctor should take pause for a couple reasons. One is that using the other medicines that we have to help with pain, you know, physical therapy, sometimes depression medicines, anti-inflammatories, there are lots of different medicines and therapies that can be helpful for you while avoiding these risky, really, opioid medications. And the other thing is, since you did have some history with alcohol and drug abuse, that makes it even riskier for you to dabble even with these hardcore pain medications that can take people's life in the wrong direction.
And
probably won't make your pain all that much better.
Risks the relapse. You risk the relapse back into those other products. It's not like we don't believe you and don't want to do it, but there's a high degree of relapse. You may not even recognize it in yourself. So difficult question. You probably do need to work with someone. If you did happen to get opiates, it would be a very strict pain control process. Be very cautious. Thank you for that really good question. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My sister has schizophrenia and has been receiving her mental health care at a local mental health agency. Many providers come and go, mostly residents, so I don't believe she receives the consistent care she requires. Should she be treated at an academic practice like UNC?
Well, everyone should come to UNC.
Yes, everyone. Well, I think, you know, a lot of this is one of those things that you should talk really openly with the doctor about your concerns, making sure that the provider understands the importance of coordinating care with the mental health agency and really partners with you and your sister over time. Some people really love seeing resident physicians as part of their care just because they're younger and they often have more time to spend with you and sometimes more time to coordinate that care. They tend to really know their stuff coming out of medical school more recently. So there are lots of reasons why some people really love seeing resident physicians. But I think your concerns are valid and it's worth really talking about that with your provider.
Some people really want that continuity beyond 1 or 2 years. They really think that, you know, this is, they're in it for life,
mm-hmm.
and they'd really like that continuity. So that's sometimes where people get a little frustrated with the residents who may come in 1, 2, 3 years, depending on when you see them in their treatment. I would say if you have a resident, maybe also have an attending physician. You can have two physicians caring for you. And that way, if the resident leaves, you still have another physician who's more likely to be there. But I would say you get good physicians wherever you can. And mm-hmm. if you've got a good physician in that local mental health agency, I wouldn't go to an academic health center. And there are a lot of community-based, really good mental health providers. I'd be looking for a really good provider.
I also think that if you are seeing a resident physician, to remember that they are, that care is being supervised by another physician as well. And so to try to get to know that person and work as a team sometimes can work really well. Good luck with your sister.
Erica, what's our very last house call today?
I have chronic Lyme disease, and I've been taking multiple antibiotics for over a year. This doesn't seem to help, and my joint pain is at its worst it's ever been. An alternative provider continues to draw blood and continues with my antibiotics and natural supplements. My primary care doctor thinks this is a waste of money and said it could potentially be harmful. What do you think?
Controversial.
I think in some respects, Christy and I will be stepping into some quicksand here, but I do think we're going to give you some opinions that we believe are based on the evidence. And that's a real question here, and it involves two issues. One, this diagnosis of chronic Lyme disease, how often does it really exist? And the second is the treatment with prolonged courses of antibiotics. Does it help?
Well, I really think it first has to go back to, is chronic Lyme disease actually the diagnosis here? I mean, it'd be very, very rare for you to have taken that many antibiotics, assuming that they were antibiotics that target Lyme disease, over that period of time and still have ongoing Lyme disease. That would be a very a rare situation. So you want to consider, is there some other thing going on that's causing these symptoms?
Yeah, and this gets back actually to one of the definitions that most providers and certainly the Centers for Disease Control no longer recommends this term chronic Lyme disease, because it implies that you have a process that's due to the chronic Lyme. And one of the things they recommend now is we talk about after successful treatment of Lyme disease, post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome or post-Lyme disease syndrome, meaning you had an exposure to Lyme, it's been documented, which you have to prove,
mm-hmm.
and yet you still have some symptoms. Whether that's caused to Lyme or not, a lot of people believe that it's not. But that way, we don't necessarily automatically attribute it by the term.
Right, because that also helps. So if that's the case, you had Lyme disease, it was treated, but then you have the syndrome of symptoms afterwards, that helps make it clear that the Lyme disease has already been treated. So you don't need to keep taking more antibiotics or nutritional supplements to treat something that isn't actually an active process in your body. But yet the symptoms, of course, are real.
And there's finally been several long-term randomized controlled trials of long-term antibiotic use to try to see whether or not that actually helps people who are presenting with really difficult symptoms. This is a difficult case. We understand that. And unfortunately, those trials did not show significant benefits of long-term antibiotic treatment once the original course has been treated successfully. And more importantly, there were severe side effects. So it doesn't surprise me in this question that we may not be better. We still got a problem. Thank you so much for your question. Mm-hmm. We could spend a whole hour just talking about this, but at least we began the conversation.
We wish you all the best with a really difficult set of symptoms. Well, that concludes the house call section of our show. We've talked about Lyme disease and mental health care, coordinating with the doctor.
About chronic pain and opiates when you maybe also have other addictions.
And about prostatidia.
Yep. Well, we hope you've enjoyed our show today. We want to thank all of our listeners. We want to thank our executive producer, Erica Lloyd. We want to thank our great guest today, Dr. Gail Thomas on Farmworker Health. And for any of our listeners out there, you all can participate in our radio show by sending questions, comments, ideas to yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Gail Thomas. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.